Hello and welcome to the Aldi podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Aldi. And we've got a fantastic piece in the new issue by Cleo Rocos, who worked with and was engaged to Kenny Everett, who would have been 75 this Christmas day. Cleo, let's begin by talking about how you first met the great, the wonderful Kenny Everett.
I first met Kenny Everett actually in the studio when we were filming. I mean, it had happened because I had been late for a ballet class. A director, lovely Alan J. Bell, who directed Last of the Summer Wine and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, had seen me running across and thought that I was a lot older because I was in a ballet in my leotard, and a lot of the students at the school I was at were a lot older, drama students.
Because you were how old?
I was nearly 15 then.
Child, yeah.
That was when I first met Alan. And then I couldn't get any parts for my age because I looked a lot older than I was. And so he said, why don't you come to the BBC and I'll introduce you. I'll give you a list of agents who might be able to help you. And so I went in my summer holidays. And while I was having lunch with Alan, the lovely Jim Moyer was...
Who would tell the listeners who he was?
Yeah. At the time, he was the head of Light Entertainment. And he also went on to run, I think, Radio 2. And he's just the most fabulous man. And he was having lunch as well at the BBC. And he came and introduced himself and asked if I would like to come and audition for Kenny Everett's show, as they were just poaching Kenny's show from Thames Television. So that's how it all started. And I was only ever meant to be on the Christmas show as one of the earringy girls that didn't wear very much. And
what were they called, the girls?
Well, I call them earringy girls, you know,
right,
the girls
right,
that
right.
Look like a lot of accessories. but I wanted to learn everything I could learn, so I would just stay in the studio and watch how everything was done, and I wouldn't go to the dressing room or the makeup unless I had to. And Kenny saw me standing in the shadows as his costume was being fixed, and beckoned me over, and he introduced himself to me, and within minutes we were talking and laughing, and it was just as if you know, just stepped into the right temperature. You know, when you go on holiday and you walk into the sea and you don't notice whether it's just all the right temperature with your body, and that's how it felt with Kenny. And
he said a very lovely thing when he first met you. He clearly said to you, finally, we're going to get on. I've met
a fellow Martian.
That was very, very funny.
What he said, ooh, finally a fellow Martian. And so that's how it was.
And it was a huge hit, at 20 million viewers,
is that
right?
Yeah, regularly, yes, around that, even more sometimes.
And what was his magic on screen first? We'll move on to what a lovely person he was. But what do you think it was about him on screen that was very unusual, wasn't it?
Well, he was the same on screen as he was off screen, so there was nothing phony about him. He was just wanting to have mischief and happiness. There was nothing malicious, there was nothing smug. It was as if everyone was included, the whole audience were included. And so it wasn't that he was ever being a star or anything like that. He never even thought like that. He just thought, well, let's all have some fun together. And I think the fact that we so enjoyed the show, doing the show together, and that he insisted that we never learn the script because he was hopeless at learning lines. And he wanted it to be fresh. And I think that spontaneity and the realness of it, I mean, I've worked on many, many television shows and nothing could be more real than Kenny's show.
Having said that, there was a script, wasn't it, Ray Cameron and our mutual great friend of the Aldi, Barry Cryer.
Yes.
So how did that work from script to screen?
Well, from script to screen, there would be auto cues that Kenny would see. Sometimes people would rush in with the board. But also, there would be times where, and there was one sketch where they'd hidden all the lines in cupboards, and all he had to do was go to the cupboards. But he got them right at the end of the sketch. He got the wrong cupboard, and then he turned to me in horror and just looked at me and said, "You stupid, bloody didn't care." And I had to think of something, and I took off my earrings and threw them across and said, look, my earrings, quick. I didn't know what to do. And after that, that's when I passed an unofficial sort of a sort of audition, I suppose, where they said, yeah, you can stay. You're never going to let Kenny fall through the safety net.
So there was always, despite the Barry Cryer and Ray Cameron script, there was always a lot of improvisation in the final product.
We would follow the script because they wrote such beautifully crafted sketches, things that looked so silly. Actually, it takes so much craftsmanship to get right, and so we'd follow them. But yes, sometimes we would go out for lunch and come back a little over refreshed, and things would go out the window a little bit.
But you write very interestingly about having writing sessions with Kenny and Ray Cameron and Barry Cryer, and you wrote stuff on the tablecloth, is that right?
Well, yeah. We'd go out because Barry used to write on the back of anything, you know, matchboxes, cigarette packets, anything he could get his hands on, he'd write. Everything would be, anything that had a little surface on would have a sketch on. And once he's, when you're thinking about funny things, that's how your brain works. And Barry's always in full throttle. And so we'd go to lunch sometimes, and everyone would be chatting and excitedly about something, and we'd say, Kenny'd say, oh, but the set is so nice. We need another sketch. We just can't use that just for one sketch. Let's write some more sketches. So quite often, sketches would be written in haste on the tablecloth, and we'd have to buy the tablecloth when we left.
That's a great expression, buying the tablecloth. because Barry Cryer is a mutual great friend of both of ours, and he's if not underrated, but I don't think he gets as much credit as he should in life. I think he's a national treasure, and he's a brilliant, brilliant writer, isn't he? Most listeners will have seen him on screen, but he's a brilliant writer.
He's a brilliant writer. I would say he's the best writer. He can write in so many other directions. He understands, there's no one who understands comedy or humour or silliness in the truest and purest and most skilled form than Barry. And I think that he's just the most lovely man. So he's not cocky and he isn't full of himself. He's just the most incredible writer. And I think I would say if throughout the history of English and British talent, Barry is right at the top there.
I completely agree. In fact, he said to me the other day, people in modern comedy, which he doesn't look down upon at all, but he says they underestimate the power of silly.
Silly as king.
And Kenny Everett comes across in your articles being incredibly kind and nice, but also you talk about him being naughty. Yeah. There are no real barriers in a world of sort of people who like to be restricted and restrain things. There were no barriers at all, is that right?
No, I mean, I think maybe it came from, originally Kenny went to priest school and he was expelled for drinking the wine and taking notepaper and writing things, you know. So, and then at a very young age, he was a DJ who travelled on the first trip with the Beatles on their first American tour, and they were all about 19 years old. So he was exposed to a lot of eccentric lifestyles and behaviours. And so I think, and I do personally, and I used to always think, because I went to a convent for a while and I got...
Was it in Brazil, was it?
No, it was in England.
Yeah.
And I gave the form teacher, we had to give her something very useful and thoughtful for her for Christmas, and they all wore full-length things, gowns. It just had a bit of crystallised armpits and a whiff of urine when they passed down the... You know, that the alarms are going off. And so I gave... She had a beard, so naturally I gave her a packet of Bic razors, which wasn't, to my joy, accepted well, so I was able to not have to go back the next term, which was a major relief. So I think there are a lot of rules which are just in place, and I think now more so than ever.
Oh yes, because of the whole sort of modern censorship.
Everyone's got the power to censor or to I don't know. And of course there are things which do need addressing properly, but I think a lot of humour and silliness can be squeezed right out. So Kenny didn't recognise those rules in a good way, because most of them are overrated. And rules are really I mean, who sits around and makes rules up? I mean, quite frankly, you know, wouldn't you rather have a margarita?
Well, God, as we're both drinking one of your delicious margaritas, of course I would. Actually, it's funny, Kenny Everett, which I grew up on, I was 10 or 11 when it came out, it's completely uncorrupted by it, but actually I wonder if now you probably couldn't have characters like the wonderfully named Cupid Stunt invented.
Yes.
Glad I've only had one margarita
before I say that. So am I.
you probably couldn't do Cupid Stunt now, could you?
And I remember playing a couple of characters in court, you know, witnesses, and one was but fabulous names. I mean, this is Barry, you know, and Ray and Kenny, you know, Norma Snockers. And yeah. Glorious boobs. I mean, how fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's just silly.
Yeah.
You know,
but
it's just
funny.
Happy and silly. And you know, I used to spend a lot of the time in that show in sort of suspenders. And it was just like being in a giant cartoon. It was never lascivious. It was never anything other than completely unnecessary. And we'd have David Frost on the show. We'd have Sting. We'd have Billy Connolly, who would laugh. We did, I think, about 104 takes to get a tea sketch, you know, right? And everyone just came on to enjoy themselves.
And you didn't mind. You are fabulous looking, and
you were fabulous looking,
but you didn't mind those names, did you?
No. I mean, you can defend me if you tried, because you're in on the joke is something we were all immersed in. We were making something for everyone to laugh at. Nobody was a target. Nobody was. I don't know. I think people's approach to humour is different. It's very different if you approach something with the end goal of laughing at it, rather than, is there something I can be offended in?
Exactly.
You know, it just
and people
depends.
Try to get offended on other people's behalf, so people
yes.
might try to be offended on your behalf. If
you're
I've
had
offended,
lots of those people calling me up trying to be defended. Yeah, I think being offended on my behalf, I think, for heaven's sake, I had the best time.
How
and I'd do it all
that.
Again.
And then you developed this tremendously close friendship with Kenny, and you had a secret code word, which was
bananas.
And why was that?
It was just the happy smiling fruit. We looked at banana one evening and thought, this is the fruit that always smiles, and so we thought it was born and grew smiling, and that felt very us.
And in 1989, 30 years ago, Kenny asked you to marry him, and tell
yes.
us about that, because it's no secret that he was gay, is it at all?
No.
And you knew that, obviously, didn't
yes.
you? So what produced that moment?
Just a friendship and we had genuinely a real love for one another. I didn't plan to fall in love with a gay man. He didn't plan to fall in love with me. But we just loved each other. We just genuinely loved each other. And we'd go dancing together. We'd sit. We'd literally sit and chat and laugh for days, literally. He'd close the curtains so that the night would last longer. And sometimes we'd go out on Saturday night, and when we finally opened the curtains, it would be Tuesday. And, you know, that was lovely. Again, bending time and changing the rules a little bit. We just love being in one another's company, but we also somehow there was just a connection that was indescribable.
How wonderful. So he asked you to marry him, and you said
yes. I thought he was wasn't sure he was being serious, but then he called my mother, and that was I think about 2 a.m. and to prove it was right that he was serious, and it was wonderful.
And what did your mother say?
She was surprised, and she was, you know, she'd been woken up, and so he said, "Well, just wanted to let you know," and we engaged, and then, you know, hung up, and we put the music on, and we danced, and it was, and he took me around. He had a giant satellite dish, and he said, "Look, Lee, half of this is yours, and half of this is yours," and you know, he just wanted to say, you know, he was genuinely.
And you say he'd booked the church.
Yeah, he'd found the church that he
found
wanted
church,
to.
Found
yes,
the church.
That he wanted to.
But you never did get married, and why didn't you?
Because as people started to find out, they started to pass judgment, and he'd been married before.
I should have known that,
Lee Everett, who was, you know, many years before, And I could see that he didn't really want to fail at this or people to be. And of course, I knew he was gay and that we had 99% of relationship, but I knew there was going to be, although he did say he wanted to have children. And so I said, don't know how we're going to do that. I said, perhaps we can go to Harrods, and because usually, so I don't know how that would have come about. But anyway, he I could see that he was starting to feel, people were saying things, people talking about him. Because only a few years before, Elton had married Renata.
Of course,
yeah. And there was a lot of nastiness, really, in the press then. And suddenly our world, which was our own world, was going to be exposed and up for judgment. And it just didn't, it wasn't necessary. And so I could see that he was troubled, and I could see it was really bothering him, and it was bothering me that it bothered him. So we went back to our favourite Chinese restaurant at the time in Fulham Road called Hans, and I just said, perhaps... and I said, you know, it was fun being engaged, wasn't it? And I said, perhaps we are beyond marriage. And he knew that I was... Otherwise, he was going to have to say it, and that was just one... thing too big, and I couldn't let that happen, and we sat there trying not to cry. But we quickly pulled ourselves together, because nothing had changed. We still adored each other, and only people were not invited in to judge. That was the difference. The door was closed again. And so we had an engagement party planned, and he said, what are we going to do? So we decided we'd have an unengagement party. And of course, Barry was one of the first people we phoned. Lovely Barry Cry, we phoned. And we had a lunch with Barry Cry in Maggie Jones, just off Kensington High Street, to just give him the heads up, because Barry was just
he's
our
so
favourite.
Kind. He'd completely get
wonderful
everything.
Person. Yeah. Barry is everything. I love Barry.
Wonderful. And so immediately you went back to your old great, great friendship. Mm. You describe a wonderful scene in Trafalgar Square in your life.
Oh, yes.
What happened there?
Well, we'd been at a ball, and in those days, the Hippodrome was all the rage, believe it or not, and they used to have wonderful parties, and there was a big charity party with Diana, and everyone had been there. And so we were in ball gowns with tiaras, and Kenny was driving home, and it was quite late, and... he said, oh, your tiara looks fabulous at night. It's all twinkling. You look like a siren. And we were shrieking with laughter. And with that, I scrambled, and to my surprise, I managed to get onto the roof of his car. And this giant pink ball gown. It was a huge dome of a ball gown, sort of cartoon size. And he got in and started driving round. And in those days, you could drive round and round Trafalgar Square. And I was making the noise of a siren, nee, 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 terribly irritating, but we thought we were being
brilliant.
Funny.
No, yeah.
And then a police car pulled up and stopped us out of nowhere and opened Kenny's door with sort of fervour. And Kenny said, get out of the car, and it was quite dark. He said, what do you call this? And pointed to me on the roof. And Kenny said, oh, there you are, Clee. I've been driving round and round looking for you everywhere. And as soon as he spoke, the policeman knew it was him. And then they recognised me on top of the car. And they were just so lovely and so, you know, tutting humorously. But they said, just go home and, you know, stop making trouble. Just go home.
Yeah,
and we weren't arrested. We weren't, you know, we could, today we would have been, you know.
Yeah.
So often we'd leave the parties. We'd leave Berkeley Square Ball. We'd go to the Berkeley Square Ball. We'd leave there. And the police would be out there because there'd be lots of royals and things at the party. And they'd often give us a lift home. We'd sit on their laps and put the
fantastic
hats on our head, you know, helmets. And it was just all lovely.
Like
everyone
a sketch,
friendly.
Actually.
Very much like a sketch. And that's what Kenny had. Kenny had the ability to license people to glee. People saw Kenny and they suddenly thought, oh, now I can dance on the table. Oh, now I can do this. You know, they felt licensed. He ignited something in people.
That's wonderful. Because one of the things when I talked to Barry about, Barry Cry, he hates that idea of the melancholy comedian, the old cliche. And Kenny Everett on TV presented this tremendous spirit of kindness and joy. having said that, there did seem to be on screen a slight melancholy. Was there melancholy or not?
Well, I think, like anything, I mean, we all have people. I always say never drink with dreary people because it'll suck the life out of you and then they'll blame you. And you think, all I did was try to help and they've gone off and left you. So Kenny and I brought the best out in one another. So I never saw him in the state that other people either did see him in or said they saw him in, right, to sound interesting. But I knew him for about 15 years, all told. So, and all we did was laugh from edge to edge.
How fantastic. And you had a very good ritual on each other's birthday, isn't that right?
Yes, and we would and this is the thing, actually, when people talk about Christmas and things and they don't know what to buy each other, we decided to reverse it. Now, his birthday, I'd buy him something wonderful because it's Christmas Day. And as a child, he always, Christmas Day and the birthday, of course, your birthday is going to be shoved to the back because everyone's getting Christmas trees out. But so buy him something fabulous for his birthday. But for Christmas, we'd go out to buy each other, find one another the most horrific things we could to try and make one another laugh the most. And it's really fun, is that you can put a limit on it. So you're having to rummage around some junk shops and things to find something really fantastically bad.
And you described a completely hideous present that you got him. And, well, you say what it was.
It was this horrific wall light that was sort of yellow and gold, but the most nauseating seasick yellow and gold, with black silhouetted stags on a hill with horrific, nasty, filigree, cheap tin thing. And it was quite big too. And he plugged it in on and I was so excited for Kenny to see it. I couldn't wait. I thought, I have found him just the most disgusting thing. He was just going to die from horror. And he opened it up and he just looked stunned. And I was so thrilled. And he took it over to the wall, plugged it in. And he said, I love it. It's got the best light. And I thought, no, it had this horrific sort of cheap version of a Balinese sunset, you know, horrible, gaudy colours. And he loved it. And I just didn't know whether to laugh or cry. I just thought, I have failed in one way, but then at the same time, he loves it. So he got to be happy.
And as I said, he would have been only 75 on Christmas Day, and he very sadly died aged only 50, which, yeah, must have been 25 years ago. So, yeah, it must have been a terrible, terrible blow for you. But you've described how you sort of turned it into even more joy in a funny sort of way. Is that fair enough to say?
Well, I would say that factually, he's not physically here. But it's as though he left me a bunch of keys that I'm still finding. I don't know how I can describe it. I feel fearless with if the things you want to do are good, and I feel fearless in that way. I feel, and nothing worries me in the fact that I actually only want to have and make sure everyone else has a wonderful time. So I feel my legacy is to. And Freddie again, there are a lot of wonderful people who all died. Freddie Mercury, they all died, and we were all swinging from chandeliers and shrieking. And you want to inspire people to not to forget to have a good time, because it's not all dreadful and dingy. And you have to bring a bit of joy and the happiness and the kernel of that, because other people, it's like a happy virus. People do feel, if somebody's happy, they feel more confident to be happy.
And I bet I only met you a month or so ago, Cleo, but you struck me as being incredibly jolly and enthusiastic. I bet you were like that before you met Kenny, but do you think he also had a tremendous effect on your life in enhancing that jolliness?
I found a home away from home. I'm obviously one that brought up family, so my mother and my parents, my brothers, obviously. But there was something else that was different. It was different with Kenny. I felt I'd never, people say to me, oh, why haven't you been married? Why haven't I thought that was perfection for me? So I don't need to search any further. I just want to have and make sure everyone realizes they can have the edited highlights. I fully expect to rush out of a building, you know, kicking my heels with glee and get run over. So I'm forever applying lipstick. And I sleep with sunglasses by my bed and lipstick in case there's a fire, of which there was when we were filming with Kenny one night. Because I think if I've made an effort, the firemen are going to make an effort. They're going to look at the sort of advent calendar of people with the windows and thinking, well, she
some of them
really
very badly dressed.
Badly dressed. Yes. And then they're going to think, she really wants to live. So
how fantastic.
So that's how
I feel. Towards the end of your lovely article, you say, I loved Kenny with all my everything and more. It's so very moving, your article, Cleo. And I'm so grateful to you for appearing on the Aldi podcast and for your fantastic piece in the new issue of the Aldi.
Harry Mount, I have to tell you, I'm your biggest fan. It's an absolute honour and a true delight, as I have been buying the Aldi for many, many years. And what I love about it is that people are allowed to say and be their fabulous selves, and you allow that, and you're bringing a lot of untainted, pure wonderfulness into our lives to read. So thank you so much, Harry. I adore you.
Well, I adore you too, Cleo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.